The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. It's nice for me to see so many familiar faces. I've been here for about a year now, and I start to recognize people. That's great. Although I'm not here for very much longer, so... It's also nice to see people that I haven't seen before. And today, after the transfer of merit ceremony, we also have people who have been here for an introductory retreat. So I'm mindful of that, and have been as I've prepared this talk. I'm honoured to be asked to speak. That's one of a number of feelings that I've been through over the last week since I got asked to do the talk. And I was really struck last week, actually, by Margaret's honesty in when she gave her talk. Is she here? Ah, okay, good, I can say anything I like then. Well, I'm going to be honest too, hopefully. And, you know, when I get asked to do a talk or anything that kind of puts you on the spot, there's a range of emotions that I go through. And the first one is usually dread. I'm like, oh no. because I think, oh, crikey, you know, whenever I've given talks before, sometimes they've ended up pretty weird. And or else everyone just sits there politely and nods. And that emotion passes fairly quickly, I'm glad to say. But then there's another one that comes up quite often, which is a sense of pride. Yes, it is an honour to be asked. It's an honour for me to be asked. I can give a great talk that fulfills my potential as a human being. After all, I've been a monk for 16 years, and now it's my chance to say what I want to say. It can feel like the fulfillment in some sense of my destiny, no less. Very heady stuff. Now, I wouldn't normally do the lecture verse when I do a talk. That's the first time I've started the lecture verse, because it's a verse to take very seriously. I'm going to quote something from Shobe Genzo at some point in the talk, so that's my reason for doing the lecture verse. I hope what I say will be consonant with what Dogen says in one of the first talks he wrote, actually, or the first pieces of his writing, Bendawa, from Shobe Genzo. Anyway, as I consider my own emotions on being asked to give a talk, sometimes enthusiasm is another one that comes to the fore, because it can feel like a great opportunity to bring together all these bits and pieces that I've read, all these wonderful pieces of teaching that I've heard from my seniors over many years, and all the reading and studying I've done in the library, and so on and so forth. Yes, that's another emotion, and the flip side of that actually is a reluctance that follows on, a sense of, you know, now I'm sort of committed to doing this for the next week or so, I'm going to have to spend all my time letting stuff bubble up when I might rather be, I don't know, doing something else, messing about in the workshop or going for a walk or something. But eventually, of course, the inevitability of the talk comes around. It's time to do it. The transfer of merit ceremony approaches, and I realize that there's no escaping from my duty, and I have to just get on with it. I have to just get on with it. I have to just get on with it. Except that the mind finds myriad ways of focusing on anything other than just getting on with it or the task at hand. Another cup of tea, Reverend, maybe? Sure, why not? Check your emails again, Reverend. Maybe, yes, perhaps I will. go for a long walk, get a bit of fresh air, clear my mind, let things come to the fore. At one point I felt a bit peckish, so I popped into Mount Shasta for a packet of cookies. So that's half an hour less to look at what I wanted to say. I think we all have our own version of that. Whenever you have any kind of deadline approaching, something that you kind of know you want to do and you have to do, and the deadline's approaching, and you look and you see all this stuff that comes up and prevents us from kind of knuckling down and doing it. So I thought, really, being in the midst of various distractions, that I would look at distraction for a talk, because, you know, if you're willing to really engage with distraction, it can be quite revealing. How do we, for instance, regard distraction when we encounter it in our own lives? Is it our enemy? Are there so many things we think we could accomplish in life, or could have already accomplished in life, had we not been defeated by distraction on so many occasions? I think, you know, it's quite easy to see distraction as the enemy. There is an assumption in there that somehow distraction is coming from outside of us. Okay? It's our family not being sympathetic to, you know, what we've got to do. So they keep coming up with all of these invitations and conversations that are a distraction. Somehow it's the world in its entirety not understanding us, not being sympathetic to us, not supporting our endeavors. It's other things, little things. It's the television. You know, there's always something on that's kind of interesting. And if there isn't on the television, then there probably is on the internet. If you look far enough, you'll find something. It's our smartphone. It's the internet in your pocket. So what could be better than that? And if these things weren't distracting us, it can seem as though our lives would be so much better. We could be so much more productive. Life would be so much more satisfying. And maybe we would even be so much more happy. That's it's tempting to see distraction like that. It's tempting to think that if we could just get rid of all the things that seem to distract us, it would be wonderful. And yet, if you imagine for a moment just what your circumstances would be like were you to be without any of these distractions, then it might well be that what you ended up with was something quite similar to the monastery that we're in now. You know, when we're working in the kitchen, we're just doing the task at hand. We haven't got the music playing in the background. I've never worked in a commercial kitchen, but that's what I understand it's like. You've got the radio on playing pop music, several conversations being shouted at each other, knives being thrown if you're really unlucky, and always there's a deadline there and the boss is shouting perhaps. So yes, we're very fortunate to be in a monastery. I'm very fortunate to live in a monastery. However, would you have found an end to distraction were you here all the time? And I think the monks know where I'm heading with this. Because I have to say in my own experience that even when I deliberately put to one side all of my normal distractions, which I can do perhaps if I am quite fearful of sitting here and not having anything to say, you know, which is a real fear. Anyone who's done public talking, I think, can attest to the truism that's sometimes said that talking in public is the greatest cause of fear other than our own death. So it's not something to take lightly. Yet, even with all my normal distractions put to one side, I know that the mind manifests one distraction after another. There can be one more stray thought, very interesting thought, one more random memory. You know, we've lived long enough to have a lot of memories, and some of them we run through again and again. Others seem to pop up from nowhere. You know, a smell can give rise to a memory, which may be a pleasant one. It may be very disturbing. Even if it is a pleasant one, it may be very disturbing. The mind can give rise to one more longing of the type only an extended bit of internet shopping can fix. Yep, and there's the afternoon gone. Not me, obviously. I don't do that. One more worry can come to the surface, an anxiety. One more plan. One more ambition. Some of these can take us on a long journey. I mean, okay, for me, I'm kind of supposed to wear brown clothes when I'm not wearing robes. I don't normally live in this monastery. I live in another monastery in the north of England, Throstlehold Buddhist Abbey, and it's very similar to here, but also slightly different. If I go into town, I have the option of wearing robes, and I usually do. There have been monks in Hexham, as it happens, for over 1,000 years. There's an old abbey there. All the same, sometimes it seems more appropriate to wear town clothes. And so, if you are in any way perfectionist, and you want really brown clothes, there's not a lot in the shops. So you can make your own. And there have been times when I've got really into sewing brown rain clothes. So that takes you, okay, it's very interesting, and, you know, you get some skills out of it. But do you really need to? Do I really need to? So there's one distraction that the mind can offer me, which I can grab a hold of and go with. It's fairly harmless. Maybe it's even a beneficial one. But to notice it. And to notice it is easiest, actually, when we're practicing formal sitting meditation, which is the heart of our practice. We're still, at least our body is still, we are sitting in a posture that is reasonably comfortable for us. It's using some muscle tone, but we're not straining. There may be a little bit of irritation here and there, but it's not pain. We're sitting still, and to be willing to sit still in the midst of whatever arises while we do so can be very revealing. It can be a real revelation. But to begin with, when you start a practice, it may seem as though all that is revealed is the breadth and variety of the distractions that we're subject to. Because there are all of these memories and thoughts and feelings that seem to arise, and because we're sitting still physically, and we're not distracted by lots of music or bright sounds, stuff going on, we tend to see what arises. And of course, we don't hold on to it, we don't push it away, it passes, and then because we're sitting for 30 or so minutes, it's long enough for several different things to arise, for us to recognize them, for them to pass. However, we may feel discouraged by the fact that so many things arise, and we may find it hard to continue sitting. There may be, and there almost certainly will be, in my experience, so many thoughts, so many feelings, so many memories, which can seem so important to explore, so many regrets, that to sit still may seem to us an impossibility. And yet, to allow ourselves to be moved by them is not to see clearly what the true nature of distraction actually is. And I've put in brackets on my notes that if you do happen to find that sitting is blissfully peaceful and calm, good for you, that's fine. Sometimes it probably will be. In order to see what distraction is, we have to stop judging it. Judging distraction makes it, the mere fact of doing that judging makes distraction into an opposite of concentration. You know, if we have some idea that sitting is supposed to be peaceful, that our mind is supposed to be blank or calm or whatever, then we have set up an ideal, perhaps without realizing it, very often without realizing it, in the face of which distraction is undesired, or at the very least an opposite. When we think in terms of opposites like this, what it does is to prevent us from seeing clearly what our experience of mind truly is. And it's all too easy to fall into behaving as though these opposites point towards something that is real and separate from us. The Buddhist teachings of anicca and anatta suggest to us strongly that in fact there is not something real that is separate from us. Anicca and anatta. All things are subject to change, and there is no permanent and eternal soul separate from us. They teach us fundamentally that we are not opposed. Reality is not opposed to us. We are not in opposition to reality or our experience of it. We are inseparable from the reality we experience, and our practice of meditation is the only confirmation of that we need. I think it's quite important to say that, because for many of us there can be a great desire for approval that drives us, in fact, to go to great lengths to seek confirmation. It's as though we feel confirmation needs to come from outside of us. Meditation is the only confirmation in itself that we need. And this, I hope, brings me on to a quotation from Dogen. Dogen was a monk who lived in the 13th century in Japan. He traveled to China and was entrusted with passing on the Dharma through the Soto Zen Buddhist lineage, just as Reverend Master Jiyu was when she traveled just 50 or so years ago to Japan. One of Dogen's first writings was, as I say, a text called Bendawa, which is collected in Shobogenzo. It took Dogen perhaps 17 years to put together all of the talks that are now comprised in Shobogenzo, and I believe it took Reverend Master Hubert, who was a monk here, who died in February, I think, it took him perhaps as long to translate this into English, and it's from his translation that I'm going to read briefly. Dogen says, "In confirming their supreme realization of enlightenment by a direct transmission of the wondrous Dharma, all the Buddhas, as embodiments of the truth without exception, have had an unsurpassed, inconceivably marvelous method which functions effortlessly. It is simply this that Buddha imparts to Buddha without deviation or distortion, and the samadhi of their delight and enjoyment in the truth is its standard and measure. As they take pleasure wherever they go in spiritual aid to others, whilst in such a samadhi, they treat this method of theirs, the practice of seated meditation, as the proper and most straightforward gate for entering the way. People are already abundantly endowed with the Dharma in every part of them, but until they do their training, it will not emerge. Unless they personally confirm it for themselves, there is no way for them to realize what it is. When they give it out, it keeps filling their hands to overflowing, for indeed it makes no distinction between for the one and for the many. When they give voice to it, it flows forth from their mouths like a tide, limitless in its breadth and depth. All Buddhas continually dwell within this state, with none holding on to any of their thoughts or perceptions, regardless of what situation may arise. Whereas the great mass of sentient beings perpetually make use of what is within this state, but without their being fully awake to any situation, regardless of whatever thoughts or perceptions may arise. The diligent practice of the way, as I am now explaining it, means to let all things be what they are in their self-nature, and to put our essential oneness into operation by following the road away from discriminatory and dualistic thoughts. When you have abandoned these thoughts and thus passed beyond their barriers, you will cease to be affected by their explanations which, like the nodes in bamboo, block free passage, or by their theories which are as convoluted as the knots in pinewood. So, in my experience, meditation doesn't make me any less distractible. What it does do is allow me, if I'm willing to make the effort, to see through the opposites as they arise, or if not as they arise, at least before they've taken too strong a hold on me, so that I may see instead that which is fundamental to my experience of being, to the true heart that is not separate from other things and all beings. This seeing, which comes from meditation, is just a glimpse, but I know where to find it, and as we all can, when I look again in meditation, again and again and again, that looking in itself becomes a movement of the heart that I can reconnect with, not just when I'm sitting on my cushion, but when I'm working, whatever it is that I'm doing, when I'm relaxing together with people, or just doing the various chores that need to be done. This is the consummation of all that Buddhism offers. Now, it's understandable that some people see this process of seeing what the mind is doing and returning to the present as sufficient in and of itself, and call it mindfulness. But it's precisely because we bring meditation into all aspects and spheres of our lives that the implications of Buddhism and the teachings of the Buddha go so much further than what one might pigeonhole as mindfulness. For all of us, our lives require us to act. They ask that of us every day in so many different ways. And to make the best choices we can whenever we are faced with the need for action, we need the precepts to help us. The precepts are offered, knowledge of them is offered on an introductory retreat. We're told about the precepts. It's an essential part of introducing anyone to the practice of Soto Zen meditation, to Buddhism as a whole. We need to know about the precepts. We need to know what they are, and we need to be able to remind ourselves of what they are. We need to understand also that they are, in our wish to keep them, no different from practicing meditation. It's not going too far to say that without trying to keep the precepts, it's not possible to practice meditation. I knew this as a 21-year-old, struggling to find his way in the world. I found it to be true for myself before I even knew what Zen was. before I had looked around to find a place to practice, before I had even decided that it was Buddhism that came closest to describing somehow what I needed to do, there was that sense viscerally, without words, to express it, that in particular I needed to be honest with myself. I don't know whether everyone reaches a point in their lives where you have to look at yourself in the mirror and say, you know, get real. You have to kind of pull yourself together. I knew for myself that there were things I was doing, ways I was behaving that, I could get away with it. I could do it for the rest of my life, but it was not honest. And it was that lack of honesty, that, you know, real dishonesty in my guts that was there all day. I could hide it, but it was still there. So that was what brought me to practice. Now, no one can tell us to practice. No one could have told me this is what you need to do. I mean, they could have told me, and being the kind of young man that I was, well, maybe I was a bit arrogant. I won't judge myself too hardly for that. When you're young, it's quite easy. No one could have persuaded me to do anything that I didn't want to do. I chose to practice meditation. For each of us, because we choose to practice meditation, there is merit. It comes because we choose to do that. In bringing meditation to play in all the various aspects of our life, and by living in accord with the precepts as far as we can, there's great merit, very great merit, because there's also a great compassion finding expression in our willingness to look deeply into our own behavior. I think the choice that we make to do this is key. And so, although, you know, there's something I heard recently that children in schools in America, in some places, rather than being sent into detention for doing things or, you know, being disruptive, whatever, in class, let me first check how. If children are about so high, this isn't going to work on the tape, is it? If children are about so high, what are they in? Is it junior high? Is that what it's called? No? 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 See, I don't know. I'm asking. What would you call the school? 6 years old? Well, that's about the right age. Anyway, if they're being sent into detention, rather than being sent into detention, being punished, they're being invited to practice meditation in detention. Actually, I can't think of anything worse. Because, although I can understand that it's wonderful, rather than to punish children in any way, to encourage them to practice meditation. But I don't know whether that really works. I think you have to choose to do it. And if children are able to choose to do it, fantastic, great. But, okay, I don't know. I won't judge that. We'll see. We'll see what people say, whether that works or not. So, it strikes me, in the popular imagination, the image of a Buddhist temple, it's often quite dark, and it's bits of golden statues peeping out from behind, swathes of thick incense smoke, gongs being sounded, chanting that you can't understand what anyone's saying. Here, of course, out of compassion for those of us who can't breathe so easily when there are clouds of incense smoke, we don't burn that much. But if you've ever wondered why incense is connected with the image of Buddhism, it's because, like the merit of our unforced practice, the perfume of incense permeates the whole of a space. If a stick of incense is lit in this hall, even though it's only a tiny little stick and it's hard to kind of see where it is, nonetheless, you step through the door and you can perceive it, you can smell it, you can be aware of it. And it isn't only that it permeates space, it also lingers. Even if it's burned down and it's gone, nonetheless, the smell lingers. Just like the merit of our unforced practice also lingers through time. So we should never underestimate the value of what we do when we are letting go of the opposites and allowing the true heart of compassion to manifest in the world. Just as we can't hold on to the perfume of incense smoke, so we can't and we shouldn't try to hold on to the merit of our actions. If we trust the glimpse of the deeper mind that is offered to us in meditation, we already know that we have no need to hold on to merit and that we can freely offer it, giving it away to all beings and hoping, as the dedication of merit that we sang this morning says, that every living being, our minds as one and radiant with light, may share the fruits of peace with hearts of goodness, luminous and bright. I really like this dedication of merit. I like the words and I love the music too. The more that we're willing to give of ourselves, the more we have, in fact. Now, I mentioned that I've been here for about a year and it's been a wonderful privilege to be here. I've enjoyed it enormously. My time is coming to an end. I have another 6 weeks or so, so I'm not quite saying goodbye, but I will be leaving after Thanksgiving. And one of the memories that I'll take with me, that I'll mention today just because it kind of connects and brings this talk to an end, is that though we don't burn incense very much in this hall, all of the incense that's offered during the day in the various ceremonies that happen is burned. It's burned together in one go, actually. And it's burned in the shrine outside along the cloister. Because it's all burned at once, there is quite a cloud of incense smoke, and yet it is still a surprise to me how, when I stand outside the kitchen, which is a good 100 yards away, and I didn't realize at first, I could smell something, and I couldn't work out where it was coming from. And it really was the incense smoke coming from the shrine just outside the hall here, a full 100 yards away. Outdoors, you know, there's no roof keeping the incense smoke in, just the great sky. There is a forest between the Buddha hall and the kitchen. It's a long way. And yet the smoke of incense, the perfume, reaches all the way to the kitchen. This monastery has fences and gates to constrain it, and yet it does not constrain the perfume of incense. In just the same way that the benefit of our practice isn't constrained by the fences and gates of this monastery. So that's, for me, as an image that I will take with me, and I'm very grateful for the opportunity to have experienced it, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to have talked before you this morning. Thank you.